Okay, good afternoon. Nice to see you all again. The topic today is the Isser HaKos. There's a prohibition from going to secular courts. This is a very important inyan to be knowledgeable about because it comes up very often. It comes up in terms of people in your respective congregations who might be summoned to secular courts, who might have questioned whether to take somebody to secular courts. And it comes up even in the context of Jewish institutions, of schools that might get into disputes with employees and things of that variety, of this obligation that when there is a matter that needs to be litigated, so the Torah says that it has to be litigated in a Jewish court and not in a secular court. So this all stems from a pasuk in last week's parasha, in Parashas Mishpatim, Ve'ela Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneihem. These are the laws, these are the dinim, these are the matters of civil halacha, asher tasim lifneihem, which have to be placed, if they're going to be placed in front of any kind of a judicial forum, it has to be lifneihem, it has to be in front of the judges that we spoke about, the shivim mizakenim. The Sifsei Chachamim explains who were described last two weeks ago in Parshas Yisrael, who went up to Har Sinai before the giving of the Torah. And others explain that the Lifneihem is talking about the judges who are mentioned in the Parshas Mishpatim, where it says, Ada, Ada, Elokim, Yabod, Dvar Shneihem, that you have to bring to the judges who stand in the place of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it were, Elokim, Yisabah, Das Kel. That whenever Dayanim sit, it has the presence of a Kaddish Baruch Hu. So this is a reference to the Dayanim, and how whenever you bring a Din Torah, whenever you bring a litigation, it has to be brought in front of the Bez Din, in front of the Jewish judges, the Dayanim, and not in front of the civil court. So Rashi gives an explanation for this halacha, for this requirement. And Rashi says that Lifneihem teaches us that you can't go in front of the non-Jewish courts. And Rashi says that because if somebody who does that, maybe Dina Yisrael Lifnei Ovdei Ovaris Kochavim Mazalos Mechalalas Hashem causes a chilul Hashem. And also, as Miyakir the Shem Alilim also promotes the stature of the foreign gods of pagan gods by virtue of going to their court system. So the question is raised immediately based on this explanation. Do we say then that this is only a prohibition if you're going in front of courts of pagans, or does it apply to courts of any non-Jewish government or any non-Jewish religion or entity? So the Tashbetz deals with this issue. I believe in Chelek Beis Simon Kovtzadi. The Tashbetz says that actually if you look at the Lashon here of Rashi, of the of Chazal, of the explanation of the prohibition, there really are these two components. Number one, Mechalal Es Hashem. Number one, it creates a desecration of God's name to indicate that the Torah system of justice is not sufficient and you have to go to a different court system. And number two, Miyakir Hashem Halilim. So he says that if they happen to be pagan courts, so then both the problems are in effect. But even if they are not pagan courts, there's still the problem of Mechalal Es Hashem. It's still a Chilul Hashem if you are renouncing the Torah system of courts and utilizing a different system of courts. And he also suggests that Miyakir Shem Elilim may be Lab Davka as well, that if you are promoting any other kind of system other than Torah, so that also is included in a prohibition of promoting some other system in a way that that demeans and diminishes the stature of the Torah. So therefore, this is a prohibition about going to any kind of court system, regardless of whether or not it's pagan. Now, the Rambam, when the Rambam describes in Hilchos Sanhedrin the prohibition, the Rambam says that it's kiyidu chayre fehevim yad b'toras Moshe Rabbeinu, that it is as if somebody has blasphemed and has raised his hand against the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. So the focus of the Rambam is less on Miyakir Shem Alilim and more on Herim Yad B'Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, of raising one's arm up against the traditions of Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. So Rabbi Bleich actually has an article in B'Nesiva Sahalacha in which he explains that if you look at these two different parallel explanations, you can derive chumras, you can derive stringencies in two different directions. Based on the explanation brought by Rashi, Miyakir Shem Halilim Lahashpicham, then it would follow that even if one was following Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, even if the laws that were applied by the pagan courts, by the secular courts, were identical to those of the laws of Moshe Rabbeinu, it would still be Miyakir Shem Halilim, it would still be raising the stature of of other religions, of other societies, of other legal cultures, by virtue of going to their courts as opposed to our courts. In fact, that's the case scenario that Rashi brings very explicitly. Rashi says, "Rafila yadata b'din echad," even if you know about one case, one litigation, shem dan, and also kedina Yisrael, that the civil courts would judge the case exactly the same as according to Torah law. Al tibiyeo berakol shalem. You're nonetheless prohibited from bringing it to their courts. What would be the stringency with respect to the reason given by the Rambam of Hekidu Heirim Yad B'Torah Moshe Rabbeinu? So Rabbi Bleich says that the stringency would be that even if you're in front of a Beis Din, even if you're in front of a Jewish court, but the Jewish court insists on renouncing the laws of Moshe Rabbeinu and following a different legal system, they say that they're not going to conduct themselves according to Torah law, but they're going to conduct themselves according to a secular legal system, so that would run afoul of the notion of Heirim Yad B'Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, which is described by the Rambam. So therefore he says that there are really two different kinds, two different shades of the prohibition. One is going to secular courts, and one is having a legal system which does not follow the laws of Moshe Rabbeinu. So we have to examine that one a little bit to see whether there's any flexibility on that front. Does that mean that a case that comes before Beis Din must always be adjudicated strictly according to Torah law, or does Torah law itself allow sometimes for the application of a civil law? We know that it does in certain instances through mechanisms such as Dina de Malchus Adina, that if I have certain laws that are the law of the land, that have to be followed for Takanas B'nai Amadina, as the Rama writes, then that can be binding upon Jews as well, and the Beis Din, as a matter of Torah law, sometimes would have to follow Dina de Malchus Adina. This might be applicable to cases that involve bankruptcy law, for example, or rent control law, as certain poskim point out, which are enacted for the betterment of all of society. It wouldn't be applicable to general monetary disputes between two Jewish parties, as the Shach writes in Siman Ayin Gimel in Choshen Mishpat. Nonetheless, if it is the type of regulation where the government cares about it being uniformly applied by everybody across the board, then that could be incorporated into a Beis Din's application of Torah law as well. And we have to see whether this might be applied even beyond the realm of Dina de Malchus Adina. What if the parties themselves say that we want to go to a secular court, or we want to follow secular law? If you look in most contracts that people enter into nowadays, if there's like a business enterprise and people enter into a business contract, so many or most business contracts consist of two different clauses regarding the adjudication of any dispute that might arise. One clause is called a choice of law clause, and the other clause is called a choice of forum clause. The choice of law clause says that we want any dispute to be governed according to the laws of such and such state. If they happen to be in New York, the parties will often say we want any dispute to be governed according to the laws of New York State. And then there's a choice of forum clause, which says that in the event of any dispute, then that dispute shall be submitted to the adjudication of a court of competent jurisdiction in the state of New York, for example. These clauses, if Jewish parties would enter into these clauses, then they would have a dispute, would they be enforceable? So the Ramban on the Pasuk in Parashas Mishpatim says that even though we have a general principle that Kol Tanai Shebamamon Kayim, that people are allowed to make any kind of condition with respect to monetary matters, and conditions with respect to monetary matters, even if they don't strictly follow the rule that is laid down in the Torah, are enforceable. So that, for example, if a shomer chinam wants to take on or agrees to take on the responsibility of a shomer sachar, then the Gemara in Baba Metzia says that he has the ability to do so. Or if a shomer sachar stipulates that he will only have the liabilities of a shomer chinam, so the Mishnah in Baba Metzia says that he's allowed to do that as well, as long as both parties agree. So if that's the case, then would we describe these laws as being in the category of Davar Shebemamon? After all, they relate to monetary disputes, so that if two sides made a condition between themselves that they're going to bring their dispute to a civil court, or they both agree that they're going to bring their dispute to a civil court, that would be okay. So the Ramban says no. The Ramban says that in the Pnei HaKananim Asur Mein Lavo, even if they make a condition, says the Ramban, even if they follow our laws, and even if both parties agree, says the Ramban, this is not allowed, and this is codified in the Shulchan Aruch. And the reason why this is not allowed is because this is not considered to be a davar shebemamon, but rather this is considered to be a davar shebeisur. It's considered to be not a matter of monetary law for parties to be prohibited from going to the secular courts, but it's considered to be a matter of issur v'heter, of ritual prohibition. Just like parties can agree between themselves that they're going to violate Shabbos, or that they're going to eat pork, or even that they're going to charge prohibited ribbis. So too, they're not allowed to make a contract that says that they're going to go to a civil court, because going to a civil court is a ritual prohibition. It is a denigration of the Torah. It is an act of Chilul Hashem. It's an act of being Meirim Yad B'Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. This is considered to be an actual ritual prohibition, and therefore parties are not allowed to contract around it. This led to a little bit of an interesting dispute among the Achronim on the Shulchan Aruch, where the Sma seems to say in a couple of places, in Siman Chavav and Siman Samach Aleph, the Sma seems to say that if parties make such a stipulation to go to civil court in a type of case where Beis Din would be unable to effectuate the remedy that is being contracted for, and only a civil court would be able to award that particular zechus, that particular remedy. So the Sma, based on his reading of a Tshuvas Harash, seems to come to the conclusion that if it is unequivocally clear that this was the intention of the parties, that such a contractual clause would be enforceable. The Taz gets very upset about this. What would be an example of that? So an example of that would be a case where they made a stipulation that when a loved does not pay the loan, the malva would be allowed, without any kind of request from a Beis Din whatsoever, to just storm into the loved's home in order to take a mashkon, in order to take collateral for the non-payment of the loan. According to Torah law, obviously that can't be done. It has to be through request of the Beis Din. One is not allowed to storm into the loved's house to collect a collateral for an unpaid loan. That's pasuk in the Torah. And the Rush talks about such a case. The Rush talks about if you have two people who enter into a contract which gives the malva that right. So the Rush says that we don't assume that the people are wicked or shayim. So we reinterpret the clause. We reinterpret the clause to mean in a case where there's no Beis Din available, where there is no Beis Din, so there's no way that you could get a remedy from Beis Din. So then we have a principle of Avid Inish Dina L'Nafshe, a person could take the law into their own hands, and then they can do whatever they have to do. But not that a person can bypass a Beis Din to run into the Lovis house to be able to collect collateral for his loan. However, the Rush suggests that in the, or the Sma interprets the Rush as suggesting that if it would be unambiguous that they intended to bypass the Beis Din, so then to engage in this type of an action which would be against Torah law, the parties would be allowed to do so, despite the fact that it is repudiation, or at least in contradiction to what the Torah requires. The Taz says that that's an incorrect reading of the Rosh. The Rosh, of course, did not mean that we would honor such a contract, and that's why the Rosh interpreted that contractual clause more charitably, but that since it is a matter of Isser, even if the parties contract that they're going to go to secular court as opposed to a Beis Din, that would not be enforceable. That's what we assume. Halakha l'maaseh, we assume like the Taz and not like the Sma. But there seems to be a secondary dispute between the Sma and the Taz, and that is with respect to the second side of this question, namely, what if the parties agree that they're going to follow secular law? What if they say, we'll go in front of a Beis Din, but we want the Beis Din to follow secular law? So, as we mentioned before, there is this problem of Heirim Yad B'Toras Moshe Rabbeinu, that you can't repudiate the Torah system of law. Obviously, there would be a certain point in which we wouldn't permit that type of practice. But let's say that just in an individual transaction, the parties say that we are familiar with secular law, we are comfortable with secular law, called Tanai Shiva Mamon Kaim, we're going to go to in front of a Beis Din, but as far as what law is going to be applied, so we would like secular law to apply in this case. So the Sma seems to indicate that it's okay. The Taz says, it seems to me that even if the desire is that the Beis Din of Yisrael will decide the case in accordance with the rights and privileges that they have according to secular law, ain't shomen lo, you cannot listen to such a request or such a condition. That's considered to be a masna mashikosu b'Torah. It's considered to be a condition against that which is permitted by the Torah. Now, the problem with this formulation of the Taz is that we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, that a masna mashikosu b'Torah b'dorashim mimamon to no kayim. If it's a strictly a monetary matter, we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, that even if you are masne amasha kosu b'Torah, you make a tanai that is different from that which is in the Torah, like, for example, the Shomer Sacha, who stipulates to be treated like a Shomer Chinam, or the Shomer Chinam who agrees to be chayav like a Shomer Sacha, so we paskin that that, in fact, would be binding. So what then did the Taz really mean? So if you look at the Taz in Simon Samach Aleph, the Taz seems to qualify his statement a little bit. And the Taz says, I'm talking about when it's really a davish be'issa mamish. Like, for example, when two parties make a stipulation, amenash lo tishmeteni shvius, that the Shemitah year, when it comes along, will not cancel my loan. Now, it's a Torah law that when this Shemitah year comes along, we're about to enter into a Shemitah year, at the end of the Shemitah year, all loans are canceled. You don't have the ability to say al tishmeteni shvius. But if the person says, this is a Gemara Makos, al tishmeteni bishvius, that the Shemitah year would cancel the loan, but between you and me, even though we're not changing the laws of the Torah, yes, we agree that the laws of the Torah say that the Shemitah year is going to cancel the loan, but between you and me, we agree that we are going to have our own private arrangement, that you're going to pay me anyway, but we're not changing the laws of the Torah, so that would be okay. So the Taz intimates that if the condition is in such a way that the parties agree for whatever would be the result under secular law, but they do it in a way which is not renouncing or repudiating Torah law, then that would be okay. It's only if it would be something like saying that Shemitah no longer works to cancel loans, or that they're going to allow for their transaction to allow for ribbis, and even if there's ribbis in the transaction, which of course would not be enforced by a Beis Din, but it would be enforced, say, by a civil court, that in such a case, of course, that would be prohibited and parties would not be allowed to enter into such a condition and would not be enforceable. But otherwise, even the Taz seems to indicate that such a condition could work. In fact, that is the way the Minchas Yitzchak, not known as a tremendous makel per se, the Minchas Yitzchak, who was the dayan of the Eda Charedis in Yerushalayim, ruled that in one of his tshuvos, that in his opinion, the Sma and the Taz don't really argue over this point. So you could say, what do you mean the Sma and the Taz don't argue? We just read that the Taz seems to say that even if it's agreed that the Beis Din would follow secular law, that's also no good. So the Minchas Yitzchak obviously also understood, like, this qualified reading of the Taz, that if they're agreeing to secular law in such a way that the parties acting according to secular law would not be in violation of any kind of ritual prohibition under Torah law, that such a condition could be enforceable as well. This is a big question, and it relates to a lot of cases that come in front of Batei Din nowadays, because sometimes parties say that they're willing to go to Beis Din, but they the reason why they're much more prone to violate the prohibition of going to secular court, this is not a justification of such violation, but the reason why some people succumb, shall we say, to this prohibition is because they have more of a familiarity, especially when it comes to monetary matters, with the secular customs and mores and regime when it comes to monetary matters, and they don't want to go to a Beis Din that's going to rule according to the halakhic principles of monetary law. They want to go to a civil court. But if the Beis Din would be willing to decide according to the prevailing norms of monetary law, assuming that's the desire of the party, so then, of course, they would go to Beis Din. So Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg actually made this type of a recommendation in the context of the famed prenuptial agreement that parties sign when they get married. It was pointed out to Rav Zalman Nechemya a number of years ago that many women didn't want to go to Batei Din because they felt much more comfortable with divorce laws. They didn't want to go to Batei Din upon divorce because they felt much more comfortable with the divorce laws of secular law, which, you know, kind of either split the property 50-50 or they have equitable distribution laws and the like, and that they weren't comfortable just relying upon traditional halakhic rules of the division of property upon a divorce. But if they could enter into a prenuptial agreement that would say that in the event that there is a monetary dispute, we'll bring any monetary dispute to Beis Din, but the parties both agree at the time that they get married, both the husband and the wife at the time they get married, agree that the Beis Din will decide any monetary disputes in accordance with the prevalent equitable distribution laws that are generally practiced by people in society, so then more women would be likely to sign the agreement, and there would be less of a problem of people, men and women alike, bringing their divorce disputes to secular court as opposed to Beis Din, which was perceived as a major problem. So Zalman Nechemya Goldberg wrote a letter in which he said that he thinks that a wonderful solution to this problem would be to allow parties to stipulate exactly that, allow them to have the option in the contract to say that we're authorizing the Beis Din to decide the case according to prevailing customs of equitable distribution law. He received a critique by Rabbi Tzvi Gartner, who wrote who's certainly an admirer of Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. So it was just a Talmud, very respectfully questioning a Rav's decision. But he wrote a letter to Rav Zalman Nechemya that was quoted in the Yeshurun publication, the Yeshurun periodical. And it's in the materials. All these things, 90% of them are in the materials. So Rav Gartner said, isn't this against the Rashba? What Rashba? Who Rashba? So there's a Rashba. There's a Rashba, which is really a seminal focus of much of this discussion, and that's a Shailos HaTshuvos HaRashba Chelek Vav Siman Reish Nun Daled, in which the Rashba was asked about the following case. The Rashba was asked that there was a case where a man married off his daughter, and he gave her a very sizable dowry. And then within a year or two of the marriage, she had a child, but then she died, and then the child died, unfortunately and tragically. So the general law in secular society where these people lived, the Dina de Mahusa, shall we say, was that the money that was given by a father to his daughter as a dowry would be returned to the father if the daughter died and there were no children. Here, the daughter died and then the child died, so there were no children, and therefore the father wanted to get the money back. But the halacha is that a husband inherits his wife, so therefore whatever money came into the marriage would remain in the possession of the husband and not go back to the wife's family. So this was the question that was posed to the Rashba. Do we say that since this is the minhag ha-makom, this is the generally followed custom in this jurisdiction, this is the law that is practiced in the place where these people live, and therefore this is the expectation that people should follow this law. Do we say that this would be now binding upon this family so that the money would go back to the father? Or do we say, no, we follow halacha, and therefore the husband would keep his late wife's possessions? So the Rashba says what appears on the surface to be contradictory things. The Rashba starts off by saying, what do you mean? Kol darash shebamamon tano kayim. He says that whenever people make a condition with respect to monetary matters, it's a separate question as to why he was treating Yerusha as a monetary matter, but we'll leave that to the side right now. Maybe in the case of a husband inheriting the wife, it's a little bit more in that realm than in other types of Yerusha. There's more room, there's more flexibility, according to the Gemara, to make conditions with respect to a husband receiving the inheritance from his wife. But the Rashba says that when it comes to Tanai Shibamamon, when it comes to a condition about a monetary matter, of course the parties can make whatever condition they want. Not only that, he says, Afilo Anosim Sham Stam, that if it's the type of a jurisdiction where everybody follows this practice, even if an explicit Tanai, even if an explicit condition was not made, we would assume Kol Anosim Stam Aldasa Noeg Sham, that every single person who gets married is getting married based on whatever is the prevalent condition for the prevalent custom in that jurisdiction. And therefore, this would be binding upon the party so the money to go back to the father as a matter of condition. That seems pretty straightforward, right? Except the Rashba then shifts gears. And he shifts gears so dramatically and so powerfully that you can easily forget that he started out in the opposite direction. The Rashba then turns in a slow burn, gradually gets angrier and angrier. He says, "Umikom makom lino kain." But he says, however, if they're only going to be following this custom, b'neishu mishpa goyim, because of the fact that they want to follow the secular laws, b'emes nearly she'aser. That, he says, he thinks would be prohibited, l'fishu mechakes goyim, because then you're doing it for purposes of copying the goyim, not because there is a desire in a particular case to follow a certain type of business custom or business practice, but because you have more respect for their laws than your own laws. He says if you're doing it in order to show more respect for their laws than your laws and just to copy them, regardless of what their laws say, that is included in Bezel Shisiva Tov Lifnei Lo Lifnei Goyim. That's included in the prohibition of going to civil courts. Even though both parties are agreeable and amenable to this. And then he goes on and on and on, and he says that if you're going to do such a thing, Leilet v'dalchi agoyim mishpateim chas v'sholom lam kodosh lino kacha, chas v'sholom that our holy people should act that way, v'kol shekein imata yosif alachto lako nachlas ha'av alabonim, and especially now you're going to engage in this great sin that you're going to deprive a proper inheritance from taking place, from being received by the appropriate heirs. You're going to tear down the walls of the Torah. You're uprooting all of our roots, all of our branches. And he goes on and on. And he doesn't even stop there. So that's kind of the second part of the tshuva. The third part of the tshuva, and the problem with this tshuva is that you have to break it down between the different parts. I think that there's a tendency to just look at and isolate one part of the tshuva and to extrapolate a little bit too much generally from there. The third part of the tshuva says, don't argue that this is included within Dina D'Machus Adina. And then he goes on and on to say that if we're going to say that every single monetary law is included in Dina D'Machus Adina, so then we're not going to have any need for any of our Torah books. What are we going to need any of our Svarim for? Just send everybody to law school. V'yibnu lehem bamos teluos. Be'beis midrasei agoyim. And you'll build your altars there. Chalila lo tia kazos kibisah. Chas v'shalom shema takor ha-Torah aleha sak. The Torah will end up having to wear sack and ashes. This is would be a terrible, terrible tragedy and a travesty. And then, fourth part of the tshuva, at the very end of the tshuva, he just kind of calms down a little bit. He says, oh, but, you know, of course, if I'm dealing not with just codifying something as dina de malchusa dina, but I'm just dealing with a private transaction, but b'mashi yisrael osim chaveiro, I have one Jew who's making a business deal with his with another Jew. Well, if I'm dealing with a monetary matter, you could agree to give anything you want. You could obligate yourself in anything that makes you comfortable, even if it's not according to Torah law. Just like a shomachinam could take on the obligations of a shoel. Blah blah blah, and that's the end of the tshuva. What in the world did the Rashba just say? He started out saying, yeah, you do whatever you want, and if that's what everybody does, even if you didn't say it, that's what we're going to do. Then he said, we're about to do this because the Goyim are doing it. That's the worst possible thing, and that's going to be a destruction of the entire Torah. You're going to tear down the walls of our tradition. And then he goes on to say, don't give me this Dina de Machus Dina business because that has nothing to do with this. That has to do with things that are the Takanas Bnei Medina that the government really cares about, building their bridges, making taxes. And then he says, oh, but of course, if you want to do it, so you can do whatever you want. So the Rashba is cited by Rav Gartner and he's cited by a lot of people for the proposition that parties can never stipulate in any transaction that they wanted their dispute governed according to principles of secular law. But it's really, as we saw, not so simple. So there are probably seven different ways to break down the Rashba, and I'll spend the next 2 minutes giving you the seven different mahalkim that I've come across with respect to the Rashba that's different from the harshest approach which we just heard. One is what's brought by the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef in Siman Chav Vav says, you know what the Rashba was talking about when the Rashba was going on and on and fomenting against the position that we should just follow this law because this is what the Dinei HaGoyim say. He wasn't talking about Dinei HaGoyim, he was talking about Dayanei HaGoyim. You have to add a Yud. He was talking about where the people wanted to actually go in front of the secular court. Not a case where they wanted to go in front of the Beis Din, and the Beis Din is going to follow secular law because that happens to be the custom of where the people live. If that would have been the case, so that wouldn't necessarily have been prohibited by the Rashba. The Rashba's problem was that they were going in front of the secular judges. Now, admittedly, that doesn't appear to be the simple pshat in the reading of the Rashba, but that's how the Beis Yosef understood the Rashba. Second possible explanation is the simplest one, meaning what the Rashba said. I'll give you all kinds of different explanations, but, you know, this is the truthful one. So the truthful one is, what did the Rashba say? The Rashba said, you can do whatever you want, but just don't do it for purposes of copying the Goyim. So as if you're doing it l'shma. You're doing it because you really want your transaction governed this way. You're doing it because you feel that you want to follow the local custom, and it just so happens local custom is consistent with secular law, but you're not doing it because you have some great admiration or respect for secular law, the secular legal system. You just want to follow local custom. So that is perfectly permissible. What's the problem? The problem is if you're doing it for the purpose of lachkos esagoyim, you're doing it for the purpose of abandoning the Torah and adopting the secular legal system because you have greater affection and greater respect for the secular legal system. So that's mamish, a violation of miyakir shem alilim, as Rashi writes in the explanation of the prohibition. That seems to be the most simple explanation of the Rashba. Third possible explanation is that the Rashba was worried about the notion of the entire community abandoning the Torah law on this subject. And it's one thing if two people in a private transaction decide they're going to do things this way because they are more comfortable with that monetary arrangement, but to enact that the entire community is no longer going to follow Torah law and everybody's just going to follow secular law in every single case. So that was his objection. That seems to be the way that the prohibition is explained by Rav Ezra Batsri in his Sefer Dinei Mamonos to explain a different dispute between the Tashbates and the Rivash, and you can apply it over here as well. Yes?
What if you have greater admiration for the secular law because you just know it better? Let's say you're a lawyer and you're not a learned Jew. You know the law better. You understand it better. So therefore, you just feel that is the more accepted or the better way to understand the law. But had you know the Jewish, it's not like a wrong way of Jewish law. It's just that you just know it better if you have greater
So then the question is, are you following it because of the fact that you just know it better and it just happens to be more consistent with your general practices? Or are you following it because you just have a general admiration for the secular legal society, and therefore, even if you would know and understand Torah law more, you would still be more inclined to follow secular law? So if it would be the latter, that would be clearly problematic. If it would be the former situation, where it just happens to be the circumstances that you're dealing with, that you're familiar with this law and you're comfortable applying this law to your transaction, but you're not in any way repudiating the Torah, chas v'shalom, then it's very possible that the Rashba would be comfortable with that, based on this explanation. Fourth mahalach is that the Rashba was only dealing with a case where the person was going to, as he says in his own words also a little bit, he'd be okia dine yerusha, where the person is going to uproot an entire body of a law, an entire body of the Torah, which is even a little bit on the fence between mammon and iser. But if it would be something which would be more squarely in the realm of masa umata and laws of regular commerce, just like we say that we define working hours based on whatever happened to be the customs of society in general, so too, it wouldn't be such a ridiculous stretch to say that we would allow for business transactions to be governed by prevalent secular law. That's essentially the response that Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg gave to Rav Tzvi Gartner. He said that we're not looking to uproot entire parshios of the Torah over here. We're not doing away with Yerusha law. We're just enabling people to take upon themselves a hischayrus, some sort of an extra obligation that they wouldn't otherwise have according to Torah law, a different series of obligations, and especially if that's being done for purposes of enabling our society to function more smoothly, and it's being done in order to encourage people to come to Dine, to Bate Din, as opposed to going to secular courts. So he thinks that that would be perfectly fine. And he adds to that that part of the problem, if you're adopting the secular regime, is that you're adopting it together with all of its bells and whistles and all of its trappings. So that you're adopting not only the substance, but you're adopting the procedural rules. You would just be doing away with Torah entirely. You're going in front of a Beis Din, and you're still subject to the Beis Din procedural rules and all of the other processes of Beis Din, but you're just saying, with respect to this particular matter, we are circumscribing our obligations to be in accordance with prevalent norms in secular society, that he didn't think was a problem at all. A fifth approach is articulated by the Minchas Tzvi, or Tzvi Spitz, who says that the problem isn't adopting things that happen to be as consistent with secular law. The problem is mentioning the elephant in the room. The problem is mentioning secular law. If you say, yeah, you know what, for this transaction, I want the following 100 conditions to apply. And it just so happens those 100 conditions are exactly identical to the 100 paragraphs in the statute, in the civil law system that would govern this transaction, but that's a coincidence. So that would be perfectly okay. But if instead of saying, I want the following 100 conditions to apply, you say, I want to incorporate the following the civil law statute and have that statute apply to our transaction, so that would be a problem. That as long as you don't reference secular law, you just are doing something which is consistent to secular law, then that's a way of averting the problem. And Tzvi Gartner says that he doesn't get that at all. He thinks that's ridiculous, that's semantics. Either it is secular law or it's not secular law, but that's another approach. Zalman Nechemya Goldberg also says he doesn't get that distinction, but in the other direction, he thinks it's perfectly permissible, even if you do mention secular law, so why engage in these semantics? But he says that if it will make you happier not to mention secular law, so don't mention secular law. And then a sixth approach is that it could be that the Rashba is every bit as strict as those who are reading the Rashba in the most draconian possible fashion, but who says we paskin like the Rashba? The Rashba is convenient to cite because he's so eloquent when he waxes poetic about the subject. We don't always paskin like the Rashba. The Rashba is only cited in the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Shin Samach Tes. I mentioned to you where the Beis Yosef cites him, but that doesn't translate into the Mechaber. He's only quoted by the Ramah, in Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Shin Samach Tes, and the Ramah quotes the Rashba for only one of the four propositions, and it's not the harshest one. It's proposition number three. Anybody remember what proposition number three of the Rashba was? We divided the Rashba into four parts. Proposition number three was that these types of rules that govern transactional behavior between individuals and society do not come under the rubric of dina d'machus adina. So that has nothing to do with a situation where parties make a condition on their own that they want to follow a particular framework. It's just saying that we don't automatically impose this framework upon everybody based on the principle of dina d'machus adina. Dina d'machus adina would apply even if both parties didn't want it to apply, because it's automatically incorporated into the halakha, like bankruptcy law or rent control law. But here, all that the Ramah is saying is that laws of when a dowry is returned to a father is not governed by dina d'machus adina. So the halakha lamaisa, the Rashba, is only actually cited for this very limited proposition and not with respect to the issue of whether one can make conditions or can't make conditions when it comes to these particular matters. So I'll just tell you that the practice at the Beis Din of America is... the Beis Din there does allow the parties to make the stipulation in the prenuptial agreement in accordance with the recommendation of Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, that it gives parties the ability at the time in which they get married to stipulate that in the event that, God forbid, they ever become divorced and there has to be a division of assets and there is a litigation regarding the division of assets, that such litigation or the such a division of assets would be governed according to the prevalent principles of equitable distribution that are currently employed in society. And the way in which it's articulated is to make it very clear that it's not being chosen in order to prefer secular law over halakha, but that it's being chosen by the parties because of the fact that these principles or this manner of distribution is in accordance with the customary practice of married couples within the society, and therefore it's their intention to follow customary practice, because parties are always allowed to follow minhag hasochem. You can always follow a customary practice. So as long as you're making clear you're not doing it in order to be mechakes a goyim, in order to choose the civil, secular legal regime over the Torah system of law, but you're just doing it because this is the custom that you and your wife are most comfortable following in the course of your marriage and your marital affairs, so then the feeling of the Beis Din of America is based on any number of these various considerations and different ways of qualifying the Rashba that I've suggested, that this would be perfectly okay. However, with respect to the other issue of parties who say that they want to go to secular court as opposed to going to Beis Din, so that would not, in fact, be allowed. So you'll ask, what about a case where Beis Din doesn't have the ability to issue an enforceable decision? Sometimes, you know, we know that there is a principle of shoftim mishotrim titen lecha. You have to establish Beis Din, Bati Din. You also have to establish shotrim, police officers, an enforcement mechanism to carry out the Beis Din's decrees. That's why when parties go in front of a Beis Din, we require nowadays for everybody to sign a shtar beruin, an arbitration agreement. Why do we require them to sign an arbitration agreement? In many cases, according to halakha, it would be perfectly fine and binding enough if you just had the parties appear before the Beis Din to make a kinyan suda, like we do at weddings, right? At a wedding, so the husband and wife don't usually sign the ksuva. They usually, the husband obligates himself to the ksuva by picking up a handkerchief which is given to him by the eidim, by lifting it up, and he makes a kinyan suda, and all is fine and good. So why not just have a kinyan suda when we have arbitrations in front of a Beis Din? The reason is because then we won't have the shotrim, we won't have the enforcement mechanism. The way in which a Beis Din's rulings are enforceable nowadays is because the parties sign an arbitration agreement, and therefore, according to secular arbitration law, the ruling of the Beis Din can be enforced in the same way that the ruling of any court of competent jurisdiction can be enforced. When the Beis Din hears a case and the parties sign an arbitration agreement, the Beis Din issues a ruling, that ruling is enforceable in the same manner that a ruling of, say, the American Arbitration Association would be enforceable if parties went in front of that body in order to arbitrate their disputes. Yes?
Wait, too far. Repeat the seventh Mishnah Rashba.
I'm sorry?
Seventh Mishnah Rashba.
Oh, I only gave you six.
Yes.
No, because I wrapped two together. Okay. When I discussed the... thank you for pointing that out. When I discussed the distinction that was made by Rav Zvi Gardner, so I said that... by Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, so I mentioned Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg said that he thought it's only a problem if you're outside of the realm of Masa Umata and then you're uprooting an entire division of the Torah, like you're uprooting Dine Yerusha. And then I went further and I said, and he also adds that it's really a problem when you're just buying lock, stock, and barrel into their entire system, so that the entire manner in which the Din Torah would be conducted would be in accordance with secular law, including the procedural rules, so that you would not require Shnei Edim Ksherim, so that you would punish a person based on Mesim Adam Atzma Rasha, so that you would just do away with all of the different rules and all of the different principles and processes of a Beis Din adjudication. But if everything is going to, the Beis Din is going to follow all of its normal rules, it's just going to substantively agree to a certain provision based on a condition of the party, so that would be okay. So that was kind of like the second side of what he said, but that's another distinction. In other words, that distinction within the Rashba would say, the Rashba is only talking about when you're doing away with the Torah system of justice, lock, stock, and barrel, as opposed to when the Beis Din is essentially following normal Beis Din rules, but just with respect to the application of this law, the Beis Din is saying that the substantive law will be in accordance with the condition that was made between the parties. Okay, that was the last distinction. But thank you for pointing that out. So the argument, getting back to what we were saying about the need for enforceability, so one might argue maybe there are certain types of cases that come in front of Beis Din nowadays where Beis Din does not have the ability to issue an enforceable ruling. We're talking about marriage and divorce. So in the divorce context, this comes up most prominently with respect to parenting issues. In many states, there are rules that an arbitration court, whether it's a Beis Din or some other arbitration court, has the power to issue an enforceable ruling as long as the parties sign an arbitration agreement in the realm of the division of marital assets, in the realm of how much support does the husband have to pay his wife or vice versa, in the realm of even child support, as long as certain formulas are followed to calculate child support, and any variation from that formula is logically explained. However, in New York and in certain other states, a Beis Din does not have the ability to issue an enforceable decision when it comes to parenting. So let's say there's a big child custody dispute, and each parent wants to have sole custody, and they go to a Beis Din to decide the dispute, and Beis Din issues a ruling. In New York State and in certain other states, not in New Jersey it would be enforceable as long as certain procedural safeguards are followed, but in New York and certain other states, the ruling that's issued by the Beis Din cannot be enforced by either party. So do we say that in such a case, the parties are not obligated to go in front of Beis Din because it's not capable of enforcement? So here, it's very important to understand that the Isser Arkos, the prohibition of going to civil courts, does not depend on enforceability. The obligation to go to Beis Din has to be couched in enforceability so that the parties are obligated to give the Beis Din the tools that are needed in order for the decision of the Beis Din to be as enforceable as possible. And if that means signing an arbitration agreement, they have to sign an arbitration agreement. However, even if the Beis Din is not able to make their decision fully enforceable, the parties are still obligated to go in front of Beis Din. A Beis Din may decide in an individual case that because it can't issue an enforceable decision, it's going to give them a heter. It's going to give them permission to go to the civil courts, but that has to be a determination which is made by the Beis Din. The same way that the Sefer HaTumos is quoted by the Beis Yosef in Simen Chavav as saying that even the types of disputes that are outside of the framework of what we call Shlichu Sayu, outside of the framework of the domain of those types of cases where Chazal said that Beis Din continues to have jurisdiction just like the Dayanim of old with respect to certain types of disputes, even though our smicha, as good as Yayu Smicha is not the same ironclad smicha that was given in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, but we are able to function as a full-fledged Dayanim when it comes to certain types of disputes, which are common disputes, where there's chisaron kiss, where there's a loss involved, based on a principle of Shlichu Sayu. If I have other types of disputes that would involve penalty payments, for example, or boshes cases, things of that variety that are outside of that realm, so the Sefer HaTrumah or somebody who did a Chabalah, somebody who physically harmed or assaulted somebody else, so the Sefer HaTrumah says that even though Beis Din is not given the absolute enforceable jurisdiction, even according to Torah law that it once enjoyed, that does not provide a dispensation for the parties to go to civil court. They're still obligated to go to Beis Din, and Beis Din then just has to make some sort of a pshara. Beis Din, if it can't decide according to all of the strict rules of a pristine Torah law, so Beis Din does whatever is within Beis Din's power to do nowadays. And the same thing would be true of custody disputes as well, that really should be brought in front of a Beis Din. Of course, a Beis Din has an obligation to be as competent as possible and to have proper people on the panel. You know, whenever we would hear a custody dispute, we always would put Dr. David Pelkovitz, for example, on the panel. So you'd have somebody who was a real expert in child therapy who would be able to help out in terms of informing the Beis Din's decision. But the obligation still exists to go to Beis Din. The only time parties don't have an obligation to go to Beis Din is when there is what's known as a heterokos, when there is a permission to go to the civil courts, and we will discuss all of the different heterim, or many of the different heterim, for going to civil courts. But before we go to the heterim for going to civil courts, let me just take a moment or two to discuss a couple of other scenarios, which are not uncommon scenarios, of institutions that might be operating like a Beis Din, but where there are questions as to whether there is some type of a middle ground area which is not a Beis Din or not a full-fledged Beis Din, but on the other hand, also wouldn't constitute an Isser Arkos, also wouldn't constitute a prohibition again going against the Arkos. What would be a manifestation of that? So one manifestation is discussed by the Rashba. It's called Arkos Shebesuria. The Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about if you have a town where there are no knowledgeable Dayanim. So there are no knowledgeable Dayanim, you might have you might have no choice but to set up a mechanism of judges in the town, because you can't have people go to civil court who are not as learned in Jewish law, not as learned to be Dayanim, but nonetheless are able to sit as a sort of an ad hoc Beis Din that would decide in accordance with not Torah law, since they don't know Torah law, but would decide according to the best of their judgment. So the Rashba is a famous tshuva, which the Rashba says that if there is a town where there are no learned people who can make up Dayanim, you just appoint three intelligent individuals who have good common sense and good people skills, and who are Jewish, and you have those three Jewish individuals serve as a Beis Din that is akin to what the Gemara refers to as Arkos Shebesuria, as this kind of a quasi-Beis Din court mechanism which enables you to avoid the Isser Arkos. And this would not be a violation of the Lifneim Lo Lifnei Hedyotos. There's another part of the Lifneim prohibition. It's Lifneim Lo Lifnei Akam, which says Lifneim Lo Lifnei Hedyotos, that you can't go in front of simple people who are not learned in the law, who are not trained and qualified and certified Dayanim. But the Ramban writes that with respect to this part of the prohibition of Lifneim Lo Lifnei Hedyotos, You can make a tenai. You can make a condition that you agree that you're going to appear before certain individuals who you are comfortable with, as long as they're Jewish and as long as it's not a secular court. So there's a question. This a body of Arkos Shebesuria. You have three Jewish judges who are sitting and deciding a case, but they're not deciding the case according to Torah law. How far can you extend this allowance? So when the State of Israel was founded in 1948, the modern-day Medina was founded, there were some who argued that based on this principle of Arkos Shebesuria, you should be able to justify the creation of a civil court system within Israel that was not bound by Torah law. In fact, when Israel was established, it was established with this civil law, civil court regime, that the Batei Mishpat, it's referred to as the Bagatz, decide cases based on a statutory law system that is not premised upon Torah. It's premised upon some sort of a hodgepodge of Turkish law and British law and Arabic law, but not Torah law. That's not the basis of the system. So Professor Menachem Elon, who served as a judge, I think he served as a judge for the Israeli Supreme Court, he came up with the whole idea of Mishpat Ivri, which became his major area of scholarship and of contribution. And Menachem Elon made the argument that Just like you can appoint Arkol Shebisurya, you can also appoint a court system made up of Jewish judges who would decide according to principles that were not necessarily consistent with the Torah law. Yes?
It's based on a different law system, not based on common sense.
Ah, so that's exactly what everybody said. So the Chazon Ish said that, first of all, you only do this when you don't have people who are qualified to decide according to halakha, but we do have people who are qualified to decide according to halakha. Secondly, this whole heter of Arkol Shebisurya is premised upon the Dayanim not following a different legal system. They're following their own common sense because they're not capable of understanding or applying Torah law properly, so at least they're following common sense. To follow common sense is okay, says the Chazon Ish, says the others as well. There's an article in the materials by Rabbi Abraham Sherman on this subject as well. But if they go beyond common sense and they're bound by some sort of a secular legal regime, so then that would be a tremendous violation. So Chazon Ish said that would be completely impermissible, and even if both parties agree, it still would be a violation of this prohibition and something which cannot be done. The Chazon Ish's actual language was very strong. He says that v'ein afkusa bein bal lifnei enam Yisrael. He says, and it wouldn't matter whether the judges are Jewish or not Jewish. V'ein Yisrael sheshofet api chukim beduyim, or Jews who make up their own laws that are not Torah laws. V'oda dava yotem meguna. He says the matter is more disgraceful. Shehim miru es mishpatei haTorah, right? The Heirim Yad Keneged Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Because they're switching their Torah system, a mishpatei ha'evel, for a different system of a law which is not divine. V'miyaskimu b'nei ha'ir al zeh, and even if all of the citizens of Israel, even though everybody would agree upon this, ein v'askamasam mamish, this agreement is worthless. V'miyakufu al zeh, and if you're going to force people to follow such a system, mishpatam gaz lanusa, this is considered to be outright theft. Ve'oshik merimim yad b'toras Moshe. He uses the lashon of the Rambam that it's merim yad b'toras Moshe, that you're raising up your arm against Toras Moshe. Ravavaya Yosef and Yechavidas Chelik Dal Simon Samachay has a similarly strong language against this type of legal system in Israel. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank wrote very strongly against it, and Rav Yitzchok Isaac Halevi Herzog also wrote very strongly against it. All of the giant poskim gedolim at the time of the enactment of this legal system in Israel were up in arms against it, and Rav Yecheskel Sarna went even further to say that unlike in, say, outside of Israel, where you have non-Jewish courts that are run by non-Jews, where you might have certain cases where it would make sense that, as we will see, you can give a heter, you can give permission in certain cases for parties to go in front of the secular courts. Like, for example, if one party is not cooperating, so you allow the other party to go in front of the secular courts. He said, in Eretz Yisrael, there can never be a heter or kos. I don't know if everyone agrees with Yechez Kassan. He says, in Eretz Yisrael, it's worse. There can never be a heter or kos, because here, the arkos have no legitimacy to begin with. When it comes to other nations, so the Arkos have legitimacy vis-a-vis themselves, because the non-Jews have the right to set up a legitimate legal court system to judge each other. But in Eretz Yisrael, there's no legitimacy to the court system of Jews as setting up a Jewish court system made up of Jewish judges applying secular law to judge other Jews. So therefore, he's extremely strict in the application of this particular principle. But what if instead of
you,
yes,
is Rebbe bringing that Chazal Sarna just to make a point, or is that a common meaning?
I'm bringing the Rebbe Chazal Sarna just to make a point. I don't know how halacha lemaise. I would say that in Eretz Yisrael, probably in dire situations where the Batei didn't feel that they need to give a head to our cause, they probably would utilize the regular civil court system as a legitimate arm of the Beis Din in those cases. But I think that the justification would be that the civil courts at that point in time are not functioning as our cause at all, so they don't need legitimacy as our cause. They're operating as an agent of the Bezin. Once they operate as an agent of the Bezin, that gives them legitimacy.
So, lechatchil, let's say a religious Jew has a din with a non-religious Jew. A non-religious Jew is staying far from it, he's not going to go to a Beis Din. So is it lechatchil better for the person to just be mochel the $50,000? Or to...
I mean, if they're in Eretz Yisrael?
They're in Eretz Yisrael.
No. You l'chatchila go to Eretz Yisrael to a Beis Din or competent Beis Din and do whatever the competent Beis Din tells them to do. Although we would not extend this principle as extensively as with respect to the entire court system in Eretz Yisrael, we certainly would apply this principle to informal arbitration boards. So let's say that two people have in their contract that they are entering into a contract. Let's say you're entering with your architect or a contractor, and you write in the contract that whenever there's a dispute, it'll be brought to the American Arbitration Association of Architects. And these are people who are industry experts, and they're not secular law functionaries. They're just industry experts who are going to apply whatever are the industry norms and standards to the resolution of any dispute that might arise. So this, says Rabbi Kiva Eger, in the Simon Gimon Choshe Mishpat, is Heter Gomer. That if this is, that if there is a practice that people in a certain industry submit all of their disputes in front of an arbitration board of that industry, but that arbitration board is not acting as an arm of the government, so that would be perfectly permissible. Not only is that permissible, but the Shach indicates that even if it would be, even if the person on this arbitration board or the people on the arbitration board are not Jewish, it would not be, it's not a function of whether they're Jewish or not Jewish. It's a function of whether it's part of the civil court system or not. As long as it's not part of the civil court system, this would be completely permissible, and that would be 100% okay, provided that they are following chavas daitam, that they're following industry standards, they're following minug standards, customary standards, but that they're not following but they don't feel bound in their function as arbitrators to follow the secular law. If they feel bound to follow the secular law, so that already, as Rabbi Bleich points out, becomes more problematic. But if they're just following industry custom and common sense, then that would be perfectly okay. Yes, you had.
What allows them to enforce the ruling?
The same mechanism that enables a Bezdin to enforce its ruling. The party signed an arbitration agreement, an arbitration award is handed down, and under principles of secular arbitration law, it can be enforced in court. And that's perfectly fine, because it's just the enforcement that's taking place in court if necessary. Yes. I'm sorry?
I mean, no, those kind of courts wouldn't be somewhat of a mixture of both the regular secular law and like the principles of that particular industry.
So there's an interesting comment by the Meiri. The Meiri, when he writes in Masechet Sanhedrin about Akaros Shebesuria, the Meiri says, yeah, it's okay even though they don't know Torah law, because they're going to apply their own common sense, and they're going to apply minug, and they're going to apply nimusim chukim v'nimusim. So that was one of the things that Professor Elon picked up upon. Ooh, look at that Miri. Chukim v'nimusim. What are chukim v'nimusim? That means they're going to apply whatever secular laws happen to be in effect. So Rabbi Sherman spends a lot of time on this Miri. Others, like Rav Herzog, have also grappled with this Miri. But the simple reading of the Meiri is that they don't feel bound to follow secular law. They might, in particular cases, when they don't know what to do, use the secular law as a reference point. And in other cases, they'll use their common sense. In other cases, they'll use some sort of a combination, as you said. So that is perfectly fine, as long as they don't feel bound to follow the dictates of secular law. Yes?
Isn't the first point of the Chazanish that he said that you can't have better hosts unless there are more learned people, not like they're unbound, so that you could use this mind? Which would be much more that you entire more learned people get the litigants to make it nine.
It's very different, because the Ramban was not talking about a case at all where the parties were taking upon themselves a secular legal system. He was only talking about where you agree to have Hayotos decide your case. The simple reading of the Ramban is Hayotos will decide the case according to their common sense, which the Chazon Ish says is perfectly fine. If you want to have people decide the case according to their common sense, that's perfectly fine. You're going to set up an entire regime of law. I'm saying this part is more implicit in the Chazon Ish. You're going to set up an entire regime of law. No one's going to set up, no government is going to set up an entire regime of law which says that the judges in every single case in the established court system will just decide every single case according to their common sense and not according to any kind of established law. The point is, once you're establishing a legal system and you have the wherewithal to establish a halakhic legal system, so of course you're obligated to do that. And you can't rely upon this notion of, oh, well, they're hayotis and I can accept hayotis upon myself. So that's just kind of like, you know, this double problem of you don't need the Hedyotis, and number two, you're going to be accepting a foreign legal system.
And on a case-by-case basis, then the Tzadik Mishra probably be...
On a case-by-case basis, I think he would be perfectly fine with the notion of accepting upon yourself Hedyotos on a case-by-case basis, although probably not if the Hedyotos were bound by secular law. So, you know, the question is, where do you draw the line? The Tzitz Eliezer was very audacious on this point. The Tzitz Eliezer said that if there is a chok, there's actually part of the legal system in Israel says that if people share cooperative dwellings, like condominium developments, and that there's a law that says that whenever the neighbors have disputes with each other, which according to his tshuva apparently was quite often, whenever they would have disputes with each other, they were obligated to bring their disputes in front of some sort of a designated arbitrator for the condominium development. So is this a violation of the Pnei Melon Lifnei Arkos? And since Eliezer says no, because the arbitrator is just going to decide according to his common sense and is not bound by the legal system. One could make an argument, that in such a case, since the arbitrator is actually established through a mechanism of a legal statute which appoints the arbitrator to function in this capacity, that is more problematic because it really is part of the whole miskeret, the whole mechanism of our cause. Maybe the Tzitz Eliezer was more lenient on that issue precisely because this was Eretz Yisrael. Maybe. But that's a little bit of a bold ruling on the part of the Tzitz Eliezer. If it is an arbitrator who's part of a court system, which is what we call like a pshara b'fnei arkos, so the Shulchan Aruch says explicitly in Simen Samaches, to thank Rabbi Black for this Mara Mokum, that would be impermissible. That even if it's an arbitrator who might be deciding according to his common sense, but he's part of the whole framework of the court system, and therefore it's a pshara which is being made not by an independent arbitrator, but by the court system itself, then that would be more problematic. Where does this come up? This comes up in small claims court. Because sometimes parties will go to small claims court. Small claims court is a part of the overall mechanism of the secular court system, but sometimes an individual judge or magistrate within the small claims court will be empowered to decide the case according to pshara, according to, you know, making a compromise between the parties and using his common sense. But nonetheless, it would seem, al pi pashtus, according to the Shulchan Aruch and Simen Samaches, that would be problematic. Okay, let's move on to the cases where there could be permission to go to civil court. And so there are 10 different scenarios that I want to discuss with you. 20 minutes, 10 scenarios, that should work. But where it could be permissible to take somebody to civil court to utilize the arkos, to utilize the civil court court system. Case number one is if you have an individual who has refusing to come to Beis Din. The other party is refusing to come to Beis Din. So the Tovea, the claimant, properly went to Beis Din to bring the Nitba, to bring the respondent. The respondent says, I refuse to go to Beis Din, doesn't respond to the Hasmonos and so forth. So the Gemara in Baba Kama says that if you call somebody very nicely and they refuse to answer, then you can take a large wall and throw it against them. So what in the world is the Gemara talking about? So the Rosh quotes a Paltoigon and saying that, you know what the Gemara is talking about? It's talking about you call somebody to go to Beis Din because he had a dispute with them. You have to know the Torah Shebaal Peh, of the Torah Shebaal Peh. You called somebody to come to Beis Din and the person refused to come to Beis Din. So then you can throw the wall at them, you can say, see you in court, throw the book at them, and take them to our calls, take them to secular court in such a way. The Chassam Sofer explains that the way in which this works is that in such a case, there's no violation of our calls. Why is there no violation of our calls? Because since the heter, the permission, has been granted by the Beis Din itself, the Arkos become an agent of the Beis Din. And their work, just like when they're enforcing a Beis Din's psak, that's permissible. Like that's the Mishnah in Gittin, which says that you can have non-Jews force somebody to give a get. If that was the ruling of a Beis Din, they say, "Asei mashi sol omim l'cha." It's permissible as long as they are serving essentially as agents carrying out the will of Beis Din. So to hear the arkos, the civil court, becomes an extension, becomes an agent of the Beis Din for purposes of carrying out the decision. Now, there is a secondary application of this, which is how far do you extend that agency? Do you extend that agency just in terms of the permission of going to civil court? Or do you extend that agency even insofar as if the award that would be granted by the civil court would be greater and more extensive than the award that would have been given by Beis Din? So here, differing authorities disagree about the answer to that question. The simple reading of Rabbi Akiva Eiger is that if you get more than you were entitled to according to Torah law from the civil courts, you would have to give back the extra amount. Otherwise, it would be gezel. Many contemporary writers, including Rav Chaim Cohn, the Dayan from Boyers, in an essay which is included in the materials, say that this is not the general practice. The general practice is that a heter is given even in cases where the person wouldn't have been able to recover the same amount in Beis Din. And that is because, based on the simple reading of the case in Baba Kama as interpreted by Rav Paltoi Gon, it's essentially a penalty. When one party refuses to go to civil court, you throw the wall at them. Throwing the wall at them means you throw the wall and everything which is contained within the wall at them. Even if they are going to end up being in much worse shape, they brought it upon themselves. It's essentially a knas, it's essentially a penalty, and therefore, even if the claim would not have been actionable in Beis Din, and even if the award that you get in civil court is much greater than the award that you would have gotten in Beis Din, you're allowed to keep the entire amount. As I said, it's a dispute between the authorities. So Chaim Cohn, I think, correctly points out that this is the general approach that is followed by most Batei Din. This is the general feeling that is practiced in terms of what the halacha is with respect to this matter. Now, what about if the nitba, if the defendant was taken to civil court, and now even though the defendant wanted to go to Beis Din, and now the entire case was completed in civil court, and the Toveya, the petitioner, who wrongfully took the nitba in civil court, let's say there was no heter or kos, he just took the nitba directly into civil court without any kind of heter whatsoever. What if the Toveya then says, "I want to do tshuva, and now I want to bring my case back to Beis Din"? So do we allow him to do tshuva, or do we say you don't get two bites at the apple? So the Ramah brings two different opinions, and the Paskins, not surprisingly, you don't get two bites at the apple. And therefore, if you wrongfully went to civil court and you lost, you don't get to do tshuva afterwards. What about the nitba? Does the nitba get to do tshuva afterwards? What do I mean, does the nitba get to do tshuva afterwards? Let's say you're a nitba. Let's say you're the defendant. And the plaintiff brings the case against you in civil court. Do you have a heter or kos to litigate the case in civil court? Even without a Beis Din, let's say. Do you have a heter or kos to litigate the case when the other party took you to civil court? And you're going to litigate, you'll bring cross motions and things of that sort, because otherwise you're going to lose your opportunity to bring all of your cross motions. So do you have a right to litigate when he's already brought you to civil court? What do you think? What do you think? Yeah. So that's what Rav Avadya Yosef writes. In such a case, yes, if you're a litigant, you have the right under those circumstances to bring the case, to litigate the case in civil court. But what if afterwards, now you, the nitba, after the case has been decided and you, the nitba, lost, well, can you then get a second bite at the apple and say, "I didn't bring the case to civil court. It was the Tobeo who brought the case to civil court. I would have wanted the entire case to be in Beis Din. I went along because I had no choice. Then I ended up losing. What do you know? But now I want to make sure that he does tshuva properly, and we're going to relitigate the case in Beis Din." So the Maharsham, Rav Shalom Shwadron, who has a lot of chidushim on the question of Beis Din in general and our calls, the Maharsham says that in such a case we do not allow the defendant to force the case back to Beis Din. And he says the reason for that is that once he became actively involved in the litigation, so then through his active involvement in the litigation, he essentially was mekabel, the jurisdiction of the civil courts, even though it's an iser, and even though it's a prohibition to be in civil court, he wasn't responsible for the prohibition, but once he made a kabbalah, so that kabbalah becomes binding upon him, and therefore he becomes bound by the decision, and he cannot relitigate afterwards. If he makes a big mecha, and he goes to Bezdin at the very beginning and says, and is kicking and screaming and yelling the entire time, I want to be in Bezdin, I want to be in Bezdin, I want to be in Bezdin, so then the halacha could be different. But if he didn't open up his mouth until the entire case was over, and only once the case was over did he suddenly say, oh yeah, I wanted to go to Bezdin all along, so at that point, says the Maharsham, it's too late, and this is also quoted by the Sha'arim HaMetzuyonim B'Halacha as well. Yes.
Otherwise, like, what power does the Nitbah...
Whatever power we have, we will issue a siruv against him, we'll issue a contempt order, we'll put public pressure on him, maybe we'll be able to get him. But even the question of issuing a siruv, even the Nitbah says, I want to summon him, and if he refuses to come, I want him to be subject to public censure and a contempt order. So we wouldn't even issue the contempt order in such a case, according to the Maharsham's reasoning. What if you have somebody who is known to be the sort of person who would never come to Bezdin? He's not from, you don't expect that this person's ever going to come to Bezdin. He doesn't even know, he never heard of Bezdin. He thinks Bethdin is like some actress. He doesn't know that there's such an institution altogether. So would you be allowed to just take that person straight to civil court, or do you have to at least send them a summons to come to Bezdin in the first instance? So the Kesef HaKachim, Rav Avraham Buchach, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, says that he thinks that if it's a yadua, it's a chazaka, that you know the person would never come to Bezdin, you don't even have to send them a hazmana. Most modern-day poskim do not paskin this way, and the reason is because since nowadays alternative dispute resolution has become so popular all over, and people who would not otherwise have thought in the past of going anywhere to litigate disputes outside of court are now more open to it because it's more efficient, it's more economical, and so forth. So now you can't take for granted that a person, even if they never heard of Bezdin before, would completely rule out the possibility of going to Bezdin. When I once dealt with a case where the plaintiff in the case that was brought to Bezdin was a major non-Jewish national bank that bought a $100 million suit in Bezdin, because they felt they would have a better chance of collection if they won a judgment against this Jewish party in Bezdin than if they won a judgment against this party in civil court. They figured the person could shield all of their assets from attachment, from judgment, and and it would be a Pyrrhic victory if they just ended up getting the award in civil court, while in Bezdin there would be community pressure for the person to pay up whatever judgment was issued by Bezdin, so therefore they came to Bezdin instead. So you never know what type of rationale or what type of thought process might provoke somebody to come to Bezdin, or even what type of frumkeit a person might have deep down inside. Who are we to define who's, you know, completely not frum? So therefore, the poskim nowadays say that it's appropriate to send everybody a hazmana, and only after it's clear they don't want to come to Bezdin is it appropriate for a heter to be issued for them to come to Bezdin. What about going to civil court to compel the compliance with the psak din of the Bezdin? So this would seem to be pretty straightforward. There, as I mentioned earlier, part of the effectiveness of Bezdin depends upon the principle of Shoftim and Shotrim, right? That you have to have judges and police officers, so what's the whole point if you're not going to enforce the psak afterwards? But do you need a heter from Bezdin in order to enforce the psak in a civil court, or is it implicit? The Maharshach says it's implicit. The Tumim has a question mark about it. A number of later authorities have written on the subject. The Maskana de Milsa, also in the Maharsham, this would be perfectly fine. And one of the reasons that it's perfectly fine is because it's self-understood that built in to the psak of Bezdin is that Bezdin is saying, this is our decision, and of course we want our decision to be enforceable, so of course you can take whatever measures are necessary in order to ensure compliance with our decision. So it's kind of like built in that you can of course enforce it in civil court. The Bezdin of America and the CRC, I should start mentioning the CRC too, also have built in to their rules and procedures that the parties are allowed to enforce the decision of the Bezdin, if necessary, in a court of competent jurisdiction. Rav Shlomo Shmuel Vosner is a little bit more hesitant about this question. In his Shevet Alevi, he says sometimes there are cases where the defendant isn't paying up because they want to work out a payment plan, maybe according to halacha, is misadvin lebal chov, or maybe Bezdin will be more sensitive to the halachic implications of working out a payment plan than a secular court would. However, most poskim, I think, take the position that if Bezdin felt that a payment plan was appropriate, it would have built it into the psak in the first place, so they're not as concerned about that issue.
Isn't it possible to kind of an arbitration agreement that takes the whole question?
If it's clear that the arbitration agreement is intended for it to be effective in the civil court, the standard nusach of the arbitration agreements that, for example, the Bezdin of America uses says that the award of the Bezdin shall be enforceable in any court of competent jurisdiction. So then it's clear. Sometimes it's not as clear. What about using the civil courts to force the party to come to Bezdin in the first place? Let's say that the party signed a contract. The contract had a choice of forum provision. The choice of forum provision said that we agree that in the event that we have any dispute, we're going to go to Bezdin X. And then one party refuses to go to Bezdin X. So can the party who wants to go to the Bezdin go to court in order to enforce the arbitration provision? Or do you need a leave of the Bezdin in order to enforce the arbitration provision? The Ramah rules, curiously, in Simen Chav Vav, that you need leave of the Bezdin in order to enforce the arbitration provision. So all kinds of lumdas as to why it should be that if we're going to be makel about enforcing the Bezdin decision without needing a heter Bezdin, why do you need a heter Bezdin in order to compel jurisdiction in the first place? And some say, well, compelling jurisdiction gives the non-Jewish system more of a bilus into the entire litigation of the case, and therefore you can't. That would be a violation of our kos if there wasn't a Bezdin imprimatur on it. Others say that the Ramah was talking about during the days when if you brought anybody to civil court for an action, you brought a Jewish party to civil court for the action, they might chop off his head. That it just wasn't a just legal system, or it wasn't, you know, completely fair. That's why there was an issa mesira. You couldn't, you know, inform on people even if they were criminals, you know, without certain extenuating circumstances. Many poskim say the Tzitzel Eliezer, the issa mesira doesn't apply altogether in a just system of law and order and a just criminal system. So therefore, the others say that one doesn't have to be quite as machmir about this. But since the matter is not clear from doubt, it doesn't hurt to get a heter from a Bezdin. What if there is a chol baror? What does a chol baror mean? A chol baror means that there is a debt which is completely undenied. It's just that the nitba, the defendant, is refusing to pay it. But there's a contract, there's an IOU, there's maybe a tuition agreement with a school, and someone's just not paying up. So you don't need to litigate the merits of the case. You just need to collect your debt. So if it's just a collection of debt action, does that require a litigation before the Bezdin, or can you go straight to the civil court to collect your debt? So the Maharsham quotes Rabbi Mibuchach in a few places as being lenient on this issue, but one of his reasons for being lenient is because Ein Beit Koach Bezdin Yofet. That nowadays, Bezdin can't force the person to come altogether, and Bezdin's not going to have any jurisdiction, is not going to be able to deal with this matter. So therefore, it's only a midas chasidus, it's only an act of saintliness to go to the Bezdin first, but really you can go straight to civil court. It's not clear what he's talking about. I'll tell you in my experience over the years, serving on Batei Din, it's very rare that you have a case of a straight chol baror. Typically, what's a chol baror? The plaintiff thinks it's a chol baror. The plaintiff thinks that there's nothing to dispute, that there's no question that the money is owed. The nitba doesn't think it's a chol baror. So the cases in which both parties agree that it's a chol baror, that they both agree that the debt is absolutely owed, are few and far between. I suppose if you have a real case of chol baror, so there's room to be makel, but you have to first establish it's really a chol baror. What about going to civil court for an injunction? I apologize that I'm not numbering this, but that's because who knows? Maybe it won't come out to 10 in the end anyway. But what if one of the parties wants to go to civil court? They're numbered on the Maror Mekom Hashi'i. If one of the parties wants to go to the civil courts for an injunction. An injunction is not an adjudication of a dispute. It's just, for example, the parties are arguing over who should be entitled to $1 million that's sitting in a certain bank account, and the plaintiff wants an injunction that $1 million will be required to be kept into place until the outcome of the litigation. The plaintiff intends to litigate the matter in Bezdin, but it needs a civil court to come along and to provide a temporary restraining order, a TRO, an injunction that requires the defendant not to remove any of that money. Sometimes the TRO is that the defendant shouldn't remove himself from the jurisdiction and run away with all the money. So can you go to civil court for an injunction? So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein in his Tshuvos indicates that he thinks that if it's in order to protect somebody's assets, that it would be permissible because you're not litigating the case in front of the civil court. You're just, you plan to litigate the merits in front of a Bezdin. A Bezdin doesn't have the power to issue an injunction. Sometimes people nowadays will go to a Bezdin for the Bezdin to issue the injunction. But if Bezdin doesn't even have a shtar beruin signed by the parties, Bezdin doesn't have any power to issue an injunction. And in fact, it could create the impression on the part of the party against whom the injunction is issued that the Bezdin already has it out for them. Because here, the Bezdin doesn't even have jurisdiction. The parties haven't even signed an arbitration agreement yet. One party comes to the Bezdin and says, I have a claim, I want an injunction. The Bezdin grants them the injunction. So it looks like the Bezdin might be a little bit prejudicial. And the Bezdin doesn't have the power to issue an effective injunction anyway. So that's why I'm against the notion about the Din issuing these types of injunctions in most cases. Only when the parties have already signed the Shtar Beruin does it make sense to bring the Bezdin into the picture. But otherwise, there would be a heter in many of these cases for the issuance of an injunction. What about if one of the parties is not Jewish? What if a Jew wants to bring a non-Jew to Bezdin? So the Tashbait says that it's not appropriate. He quotes a medrash in Parshas Shoftim. He claims a Tanhuma, something that even non-Jews should really go to. How about the Din, he says? That if you have a dispute with a non-Jew, so you should bring the non-Jew to our Bezdin. It's just that in most cases, it can be assumed that their world is not the world of Bati Din. It's legitimate for them to go to civil courts. They don't have an Issur HaKos. So since they don't have an Issur HaKos vis-a-vis themselves, it's just that we should go to, the way to frame this is that we should take a non-Jew to a Bezdin as opposed to a civil court, but it's not a prohibition upon themselves per se. So therefore, it can be assumed that they wouldn't necessarily want to go, and one doesn't if they have to issue a Hazmana. But if the non-Jewish party says, I want to litigate in Bezdin, then the Jewish party is obligated to litigate in Bezdin. The Kopitz Haposkim quotes that we wouldn't issue a seiv against the Jewish party in such a case refusing to come to Bezdin, but it's the proper thing to do to come to Bezdin. I've dealt with a few cases like that where non-Jewish, I mentioned one, there were others where non-Jewish party wanted to bring the Jewish party to Bezdin. It's appropriate for the Jewish party to agree for the case to be heard in Bezdin. What if one of the parties is covered by an insurance policy? So here, there are a number of poskim who take the position that if, let's say you have a tort where one person is harmed on the other person's property, for example, and the other party has homeowner's insurance. So the real party, or let's say a doctor, committed arguable malpractice, and the doctor has malpractice insurance. So do you have to take the doctor to a Bezdin, or can you take the doctor to the civil court? Because the civil court, because the insurance carrier is going to respect the civil court judgment, but isn't necessarily bound, according to the insurance contract, to respect the Bezdin judgment. So do we say that since your real claim is against the insurance company, since they're the party that's going to end up paying the money, that you have the right under those circumstances to take the insurance company to a civil court as if they be a non-Jew, assuming that the assumption is that they wouldn't want to come to Bezdin? So most poskim are lenient on the subject. Rav Avram Sherman wrote a long tshuva in which he says no, that based on the premise that you're never allowed to go to civil court unless a Bezdin first determines that there is a valid halakha claim, says first you would have to make a determination that there's a valid halakha claim. Others say, no, you don't need a valid halakha claim. There's an insurance contract that says even if there's no valid halakha claim, as long as there's a valid insurance claim, the insurance company will pay. They're the real party in interest. And therefore, you can take the insurance company to the civil court, even though the named party will be the Jewish party, but everybody knows that it's really the insurance company, as long as it's the type of matter where people are typically covered by insurance. Last thing I want to mention, just before we close, is that even though I've been talking about the violation of going to the Arkos and so forth, there is no mitzvah to go to Bezdin. You don't have to go to Bezdin. You can go your entire life and never go to Bezdin. It's perfectly permissible to settle all of your differences and disputes amicably. In fact, it's even considered to be a good thing that we believe that Lo Masa Kodesh Baruch Hu Kli Machzik Baruch Hu Yisrael Elo HaShalom Shenemar Hashem Oz Amo Yitei Hashem Yivarech HaSamo VaShalom Yitzu Hashem. We should all be able to live our lives B'Simcha B'Shalom U'V'Shalva and resolve any kind of dispute that we have in the most amicable possible fashion. Thank you very much. Thank you.